From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest, Dan Clores, has made quite a name for himself in making documentaries in the last few years. Of course, the great film Crazy Love. His films tend to be about different points of view on the same incident. And you would think it would make the films more complicated, but in fact, those points of view tend to illuminate the subject. His new film from the ESPN series, 30 by 30, is the film Winning Time, the great story of Reggie Miller and his incredible postseason play in the 90s. Almost, in fact, to taunt Spike Lee for giving him such a hard time during when the Pacers were playing the Knicks. Dan, first of all, thanks for being here.
Elvis, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And I'm really fascinated by that because all of the films you made as documentaries have been about these different points of view on the same story. And I wonder where that comes from for you.
I initially wanted to do this movie on a photograph taken in Madison Square Garden of Reggie making a big jump shot against the Knicks, and it was the horror on the faces of the people in the first and second and third row of Madison Square Garden. I interviewed 31 people, players, coaches, media, and they were all pretty comfortable. So Spike's comedic nature really comes out in the film. I mean, even Patrick Ewing is smiling throughout the entire film, which proved to me that he's growing up now. But Spike and Reggie and John Starks, though that threesome, largely, that's what the film is largely about. There are four moments, and I was very keen on that. I saw that immediately, that there are four moments when John Starks gives Reggie a headbutt in 1993.
Which was a shocking moment when people saw that.
Shocking moment. There had never been a headbutt before in the NBA. And the next year, when Reggie comes to Madison Square Garden as performance artist, the series is tied 2-2, the playoff series, and the Pacers are losing, and he scores 25 points in the fourth quarter, leading Spike Lee and Reggie to have this immense conflict where Reggie gives him the choke sign, where Reggie grabs his crotch, and Spike's wife is sitting next to him. And the headlines the next day were not on the sports pages. The tabloids, all three, put it on the wood, blaming Spike Lee for the loss. So that was moment two. The next year, game one, back in Madison Square Garden, the Pacers had only won two times in 31 games at Madison Square Garden. Reggie on the big stage, game one, the Pacers are down 6 with 18 seconds to go. Reggie Miller scores 8 points in 9 seconds. Winning time. The Knicks choke. Reggie is heroic. The city hates him because Reggie doesn't win. He walks out of there and brags. Starks choked. Mason choked. The Knicks choked. We're going to sweep this series. I mean, can you imagine doing that in New York? So that's moment three. Moment four, seventh game of that same series. Remember, the Pacers have never defeated them in a playoff series. The Pacers are up 2 with 5 seconds to go. The Knicks have the ball. They give the ball to the great Patrick Ewing. And in an operatic way, and he describes it, he drives to the basket. The sea is open. Last year he made that shot. Same circumstances. The giant Ewing lays it up and around and around and out. Those four moments. Everyone has a different perspective, interpretation. Everyone in the film. That's what was fun for me. I loved that. I saw that right away, and that's what I was looking for.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the director of the film Winning Time on ESPN, Dan Clores. By the way, when's the film going to be on ESPN?
The film comes out Sunday night, March 14th at 9 o'clock. It follows their bracket show. And it has a couple of commercials, which is sort of a drag.
Talk about where the title comes from. That comes from a model shot at the beginning of the film.
Well, I was originally going to call the film King of the New York Streets, which was
a Dion song.
Dion DiMucci song from the late 80s, which I loved. But I've never made a film, Elvis, where I had a title in the beginning that's ended up being the title.
Is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely true. I felt somewhere along the line that it was too narrow. It only appealed to people in New York. I love the song. And when I interviewed Ahmad in Atlanta, He was referring to Reggie making these two great foul shots in Game 1 of 95, and prior to that, John Starks blew two. And he said, Magic Johnson called it winning time. What will you do in winning time? If you were a star in winning time as a pro, you were a star in winning time in the third grade, as a high school athlete, in college. And I love that phrase. And I actually asked Ahmad if I should use it as his line or give Magic credit. Ahmad said, no, give me the credit.
And this is a great perspective, too, because what it says is that, you know, keeping your head during that crucial moment is what really makes you different from just an athlete. It makes you that thing that is, again, that kind of awareness that an athlete on that level has, isn't it?
Well, but there's not many on that level, and that's Ahmad's point. That's the difference between a great athlete and a superstar. That's absolutely true. I was once at a news conference years ago, and I think when ESPN had the 50 greatest athletes of all time, something like that. And on stage, I'll never forget this, was Jim Brown, Bill Russell, Martina Navratilova, Gretzky, and Carl Lewis together. And something happened. I'm just watching them, and they're different than all of us. You could see mentally that they don't even think like us. There's a combination of vanity and narcissism, but discipline, that they don't have to say anything. You could just see it. I just saw it and felt it. And very few people have that, and Reggie has it. The difference between Reggie and all of those people is that Reggie has an incredible personality.
Yes, and also completely analytical, and not just in that way that sometimes sounds like narcissism, because he understands himself and his place in the game. And to hear him talk about that still all these years later is really fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. So I made the movie about a performance artist, not a basketball player.
And probably one of the most self-aware basketball players ever to come down the pike. I mean, in a way where it's just not narcissism, but somebody who has an understanding of who he is as both a player and somebody who is intensely competitive.
Intensely competitive, strong-willed, comes from a military background, but lived his life in the shadow of his sister Cheryl, 1 year older.
And who's just as a remarkable basketball player as he.
Probably the greatest woman ever to play the game. And that's why Reggie acted out. His way of expressing himself, of being in the shadow, of being destroyed, beaten, humiliated by his sister, was to talk, to work and talk. And to Reggie, years later, the New York Knicks, it was Cheryl all over again, he says in the film.
It's just so fascinating to hear him have that kind of what seems like distance, but as he talks about it, you realize he still feels all those things. I mean, none of that stuff has abated in the years since that series.
No, not because I think all of us are like that. I mean, you know, you can have as much therapy in the world as you want, but the difficulty is believing that you're not 16 anymore. Very few athletes can pull off what he pulled off, just like very few entertainers can. You know, it takes a long time to be able not only to come to Broadway, but to excel. A long time to come to Carnegie Hall and excel. And Reggie's stage was Madison Square Garden. Michael Jordan did it everywhere.
And so you talked about four key moments, but it's also another key thing that happened there, too. That was the time when Michael Jordan had retired from the league, so it was a different NBA for a while.
Well, both of these teams, Indiana and the Knicks, were very similar. Both teams had last won a championship in 1973. The Pacers were a great ABA team. They won three championships in 4 years.
And the NBA always seemed like that team that came close and could never quite go all the way.
Correct, correct. So neither team then had they had losing cultures to the mid-'80s. Both then were lucky and fortunate, and they got stars, Patrick Ewing for the Knicks and Reggie Miller for Indiana. Both teams hired great coaches, Larry Brown and Pat Riley. And the teams were built in similar fashions, brutal, physical, Ewing, Mason, Oakley, Smiths, the Davis boys. Neither team had great, great point guards who were quick and could penetrate, but they had tough point guards. And both teams never took a back seat. This was a day only 15 years ago in the NBA. Teams hated each other. I watched, the Lakers and Miami had an overtime game in Miami, and it was a great game. After the game, they're hugging each other. You know, you can see they're ready to go out. Pat Riley didn't allow his guys to talk to the opponent, even if they roomed together in college.
And that was the fascinating thing, too, and this, that your films have also, each of them, been about the end of an era, and this film is about the end of that era where New York basketball meant everything to New York fans.
Well, New York is a basketball town, as Indiana is a basketball state. New York's had a drought in the last 10, 11 years.
That's my point. I mean, that era seems to have passed for quite a time.
It's passed for quite a amount of time, but people want to cheer for the Knicks. They want to feel again. And the same thing in Indiana. Indiana has hit the doldrums. I tell you, when I'm out there for the screening, I told you what Barkley said. You know, it's the biggest crowd you had all year, 8,100.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to director Dan Clores. His film, which will be on ESPN on March 14th, is Winning Time. But also that sense of a team belonging to a city has almost disappeared from the NBA. And the film is about that in some ways as well.
Well, yes. Indiana, this incredibly intense basketball culture.
And would you say on every level, high school, college, everything you can think of.
Before that, yeah. Before high school, the towns. Look, because that's what happened. Indiana was an industrial state, and so the way to socialize in the second decade of the 20th century was through a town each creating basketball teams. So towns closed down on Friday and Saturday nights, and then as different companies came in there, they had company teams, which was what AAU was called years ago.
Sure.
So the teams were that they built. Indiana has 24 of the 27 largest high school arenas in the country. 41,000 people once showed up at a high school championship game. And New York City, great pride in its basketball.
But the basketball here in this city epitomizes the way the city regards itself, that kind of swagger, that kind of style. During those key years in the early 70s when it was Walt Frazier and those guys, it felt like those guys were real representatives of New York City in a way that no other team did.
Well, yes and no, because you had St. John's and NYU teams in the 50s and mid-60s when people loved college basketball.
But I mean, as a professional team, I don't think any team has ever felt like a representation of the city to the extent the Knicks of the early 70s did.
And the reasons being, in my opinion, they personified teamwork. They personified leadership. Red Holtzman was quiet and strong. They were a mixture of race. They were Monroe, Barnett, Willis, Bradley, DeBuscher, Phil Jackson. They were mature. And this is, I mean, Pete Axelm wrote the book, This is the City Game. I mean, you're a kid growing up. I mean, I remember before I was allowed to play in a schoolyard with backboards and a rim, which, of course, had no nets because the older kids had to play there. You'd play in the fire escape. You'd put the fire escape out. You'd take a dodgeball and shoot it through the bottom. You know, so basketball was it. It was basketball and stickball. You know, I remember like when I was in about 17, a friend of mine said to me, let's go play tennis. I said, tennis? What are you talking about? And he just said, hey, schmuck, you think when we're 24, you'll be able to say to a girl, let's go play stickball or basketball?
We'll take a break. My guest is Dan Clores. His new film, Winning Time, is on ESPN March 14th. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. It's taking my guest Dan Clore. It's a long time to get to Carnegie Hall, but he's here. We're talking about his new film, Winning Time, on ESPN March 14th. You should talk a little bit about your background, because you came to filmmaking fairly late in life.
Yeah, I was a journalist, freelance writer. I wrote one book in my late 20s on the popular culture of college basketball. I moved back to New York where I was raised, and I was broke, and I got into political consulting and then public relations. So I did that for 20 years. I built a pretty successful firm. Was bored and humiliated by that for many, many years.
Bored and humiliated.
And humiliated. But
why humiliated?
Because I never wanted to do that. I always felt that I had more to offer. The good part about it, though, the reason that I was really successful is because I acted as if I was an editor, as a creative story editor. And I was an editor at a number of magazines. And I also learned how to deal with people in crises in particular, which has helped me. I learned how to listen to. I mean, I created a big firm, and I sold it to the employees years ago, and I've never been happier.
It's funny, because one of the things that I would think that would have helped you with is just learning that there are several sides to every story. And there's often, it's why I'm implicit, you know, there's often a secret side to a story that has to be kept out of the papers. And a lot of these things you've done have been about these secrets that were not told in the actual initial telling of the story.
Yeah, I think what attracts me is probably no different than most people is love and loss. I think that I spent 20 years, no more than that, as a guy in the background. So I observed a lot. That helped me. But most of what I only want to do what I'm interested in. I'm too old to do someone else's project. I don't want to do anyone else's movie or doc, anything like that. So I'm in love, which is pretty good.
Just hearing you talk about this and then the enthusiasm you're talking about, you must have missed the whole social aspect of a story when you worked in publicity, because it's one of the things you never really get to explore, and it's something you've gotten to do in these films. This is basically the kind of socioeconomic phenomenology.
No, I was a PhD student in American history, and that's one of the reasons I was so good in PR. I was great at news. I always analyzed things. I didn't have to sell them in an analytical way. But
you never got to exert and show all these sides of the story. Some part of you must have been dying for a chance to play out every aspect of the story.
Absolutely.
Because you have to control the story in PR.
You have to, yeah. So I was a self-loathing PR person.
And I'm guessing almost on some level, every time you became more and more successful at, that must have tied you closer to something that you weren't that crazy about doing in the first place.
Because
the more successful you are, the more clients you get.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I was able to earn money and have a family and take care of them, and that gave me the freedom to leave. I got sick in about 1997, and I got hepatitis C, had to do the treatment. And after that, on some subconscious basis, I said, that's it. I'm doing what I want to do.
We're not talking about another treatment. This is the treatment, my guess is Dan Clore. His film as director, his newest film, is Winning Time, the great story of Reggie Miller and his incredible postseason play in the 90s. I guess I find myself thinking about this, though, just because, too, these films are so much about people talking about a peak that has passed, all these documentaries that you've made.
Yes, true. Boys of Second Street Park.
Which is your first film.
The first film, made on Showtime, Sundance in 2003. Yes, about the counterculture, the safety of the schoolyard. Those guys are still around, but they're friends of mine, many of them. But that the peak of their life was then, in the schoolyard, for many.
And you say the same thing about Ring of Fire as well.
Emil Griffith, of course, the what's the happiest time and the most secure time in his life, and all those people around him when he becomes the champion.
There's a period in the film Ring of Fire, which people should see, by the way, when he exults in that period when he was the king of the New York streets.
Yeah. Emil, a lovely man he was, and then, you know, the whole facade, because he was the king of the streets, and publicly they had to paint him as this womanizer and, you know, blondes on his arms and all of that, and of course that film is about his deep secret, his sexuality. So, but that was his moment, and actually it's the same thing with Viva Baseball and Black Magic. The moment was on the court or the field. Young, virile, great at what they do, recognition, safety, security. Then life moves on. And in Crazy Love, well, what's his moment when he's...
His moment when he's a young man, he thinks he can have anything he wants, including this woman, and he thinks he's entitled to having her. And when he can't have her, he damages her so no one else can.
Absolutely. And her moment is when she's being pursued by this man who has an airplane, a home, two cars, jewelry, mink coats. Unfortunately, he also had a wife.
Yeah. Which, again, is that secret that this is a part of everyone who's seen you talk. For the most part, there's some piece of hidden information.
Hidden information. Well, that's isn't that great when it unfolds? I mean, that's
the
challenge.
It really is. It really is. And I just wonder if you have some sense of which of these things intrigues you more, if it's just that whole kind of conflation of all of these elements.
I think it's the vulnerability that I share with my subjects. I think that's what grabs me. I always felt like I was the outsider, not part of it. And I think that's the pull for me. Doing what I did for all those years in PR enabled me to remain in that place as the outsider.
Wow, that's fascinating, because one of the things that strikes me about all these films is that at one point you can see this kind of almost imperial arrogance of the subject at one point in his life or another. And there's something about that that you like, showing, because then they get to look back in every single case and sort of dissect that.
Yes, because I think it parallels my state.
How so?
Because now I could look back.
But do you see some kinship with you in that arrogance of these protagonists I'm talking about?
Arrogance, maybe not. I'm not sure I would use that word. Maybe others would. I don't know. But
okay.
You know? But I don't have any idea. But
you see what I'm talking about in these subjects, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I'd have to explore that. You know, that word arrogance, and not in terms of me, in terms of the subjects. I mean, Reggie clearly, and some of those guys in Black Magic, yes, but they've all, you know, Reggie was a child with braces on his legs till he was 5 years old. And then here's Cheryl. I mean, I love the part in the film where, you know, he's finally able to feel when he's a junior in high school.
Oh, my God.
That he's done it. He's made it. He goes with his mother to his high school game. He's a junior, has his highest scoring game ever.
40 points.
Scores 40 points, comes back home, sees his sister and his father, and wants to brag. He's so happy. Who wouldn't? I had my greatest game ever, 40. How'd you do? To Cheryl, I did pretty good. Well, what'd you do? She says, I got 105. Cut to Roger Mudd on CBS Evening News. California schoolgirl, 105 points in one game. What does he say? I couldn't win. I couldn't win.
And that's that moment. We should keep in mind, too, what that did to a boy to have his sister so thoroughly outstrip him in a time when there wasn't a WNBA and women's basketball was barely taken seriously in the mainstream.
Yeah, but, you know, part of that is what I love doing what I do, because you have to learn to listen and then ask. And I liked what I asked Reggie then. I said, well, how was it? Did the other boys in the neighborhood tease you because your sister was always beating you down? And he said, how can they tease me? She was doing the same thing to them.
That's a great moment. It's the treatment. We're talking about a number of things from my guest director, Dan Clores. But his new film, the new documentary he just made for ESPN is Winning Time, which will be on ESPN on March 14th. There are so many things that seem to attract you in it, but there are always moments. And you get to be a reporter again in doing these films, and that's got to be something that you've been missing in your life, hasn't
it? Totally. I was becoming a decent writer We're talking 79, 80, 81. I was always a great reporter, actually, because I did cops and robbers stuff. That's what I did.
That was your beat.
And I go undercover, you know, and I love that. But, yes, I've done six films with the exception of Jack Newfield interviewing Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill for Ring of Fire. I've done every interview myself, and, you know, I prepare, of course, on my own. It takes me a long time to do each film because I'm, you know, I can't bear making a mistake. I've never watched a film, Elvis, that I've made after it's come out.
What?
Never.
Why is that?
First of all, you get tired of them after a while. But secondly, I don't want to see what I could have done better.
It's so interesting because all these films have been about moments that could be. In some way kind of a victory and also a scar. I mean, they're never just victories. There's a complication. These moments, they're ostensibly winning moments. There's always an enormous amount of pain beneath each one of them. Each win has a cost, you know, often disastrous. But you feel like those – that did the pain come from you, the cost of winning? Or was it just kind of a – this kind
no,
of
No, I didn't win too much. So at least I wasn't aware of it, you know. And because what is winning? Winning isn't – a game. Winning is something that you're embraced by the people that are supposed to love you. That's winning. It's not, oh, you win a game. I won plenty of games. I played ball all my life, you know. I hit shots to win games, you know. Those were very temporary.
But do you feel like these films are victories for you, just getting them
done? Yeah,
in?
I now. I never did. Now I feel I'm pretty good, you know, and I'm able to integrate that feeling into myself now. You know, I am.
Because I guess I just find myself wondering that you say it takes a while to make them, but you basically made a film every other year for the past decade. That's a pretty intense number of films to get out.
Yeah, I go right from one to another. I've made six in the last 9 years and four went to Sundance, which was pretty cool.
Yeah. What was that first time at Sundance like for you when you got the film in?
That was a triumph. It was Boys of Second Street Park, and I didn't know what Sundance would be about. And this film, Winning Time, I'll tell you, it's part of ESPN's 30 for 30, but they weren't considering it, at least in their interviews in the New York Times, as one of the things that they were considering their best. They did all the interviews, ESPN. They never mentioned it, which really annoyed me, actually. It's a New York story. I'm a New York filmmaker. And then they said, okay, we're gonna propose a bunch of films to Sundance, Dan. And I said, no, you do what you do with your films. I'm going to put my film into the nomination process. My film got picked and, you know, I only won.
I guess another victory for you.
That was a victory.
Well, we're out of time. Dan, thanks so much for being here. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks, Elvis. Thank you, man.
My guest is Dan Cloris. His film, which will be on ESPN March 14th, is Winning Time. Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Leszek Borczyk at Carnegie Recording Studios in New York. Bob Carlson is the editor. If you have a comment on today's show, and I hope you do, go to the KCRW website, type in kcrw.com/thetreatment. The producer of the show is Gemma Dempsey. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm feeling competitive now. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.